welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Welcome to Syosset Library's Turn the Page podcast. This is Jessica. I am your host, and I am here with the author of a book when first like the title and the description came up. You know, I was like, yes, all of these things are things that I want to read about. There is no question that not only am I going to want to read this book, but I'm going to want to chat with this author. So welcome to the podcast, Maggie Thrash, author of Rainbow Black. And that is the tiniest cup of coffee I've ever seen. This isn't a video podcast, but I will say, you know what? I'm going to take a picture of it.
It's just actually a cup of tea, if that makes it less interesting to you.
Is it? Do you mind if I take like a little picture?
Because no, go ahead.
Adorable. It is. Hang on, I'm going to do this. So it is like adorable. I am a perennial coffee drinker. I drink coffee all the time. Anyone will tell you who knows me. And so it's very tiny. So that is an adorable tiny cup of tea.
Thank you. Yes, I'm a green tea drinker. I drink it pretty much all day long until I switch to herbal tea around like 9.
See, I would be a much healthier person probably if I did that. But let's talk about Rainbow Black. So this book was really great. It definitely got me in a lot of different ways. You know, books that take place around incidents around my childhood are always very big to me because I'm in that point now. You know, you've got like the 80s, 90s vibe going there. You know, it's a really interesting queer story in many different ways, and it's a satanic panic story, and that is all like trifecta perfect for me. It's so funny because like, I'm not really sure exactly how to describe it genre wise, but it's amazing. So why don't you talk a little bit about Rainbow Black and just sort of where the inspiration came from? And if you had to assign it a genre, what would you assign it?
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up because, of course, the Library of Congress has to assign every book a genre. And it's kind of like, ooh, you open the book and you're like, I wonder what I got. And I was curious how they were going to deal with it. And they ended up assigning it the genre moral panics, which I didn't realize was a genre.
We need to make that a genre because I think it's a really important thing for everybody to realize happens way too much.
It happens way too much, and it happens over and over and over. And moral panics are fascinating to me because they're so disposable. People forget, like, we keep litigating the same things over and over and over because these panics happen and then they end and we all forget and it all gets thrown into the trash. And often these panics are litigated at the most like trashy level of our culture, like in tabloids, on talk shows, these days, you know, on Twitter. And it's in 5 years, it's as if it never happened. And so we never have closure on these issues, which tend to be about America's unresolved relationship with its puritanical roots. So I really wanted to explore that with the book. And I was inspired too, because I don't know what your birth year was, but I was born in 1985.
I'm older than you. I'm 79.
Okay. So you yeah. Probably, do you remember the Satanic Panic?
I remember parts of it. And one of the things I say on here a lot is, you know, it was very weird for me because, you know, I did because Long Island had some serious satanic panic issues now that I think of it, you know, but like I didn't see it so much in the town where I was growing up. Although, you know, you learn a few towns over, there was some stuff going on. But what I do say a lot and what I do remember, and this is something I have in my notes, is that like my big joke is the Satanic Panic and like Geraldo and Sally Jesse Raphael is the reason why I did not start playing Dungeons and Dragons until I was in college. Because, I mean, my parents were kind of overprotective, but at the same time, I was also kind of a latchkey kid at a certain point where, I'd let myself in my house and that's what was on when I came home. And it was all like these people like talking, talking about Satan and
Talking about
satanic,
how Dungeons
and
and
like a dungeon.
Dragons was going to turn your children into Satanists. And there were these myths, these urban legends that Dungeons and Dragons players were murdering each other as
Yes,
part of
and
the
there was a
game.
movie. There was a movie called Monsters and Mazes with Tom Hanks that was about that. Yeah. And people were like, and the case that it was inspired by was complete, it was completely taken like in a it was completely taken out of context. It was not as one might imagine. Yes, there was somebody who it was based on who was I believe a D&D player. I have to fact check this. And he did, like, there was a murder, but it wasn't like he went nuts and thought his parents were orcs or whatever. It
Exactly. It
wasn't.
was so over the top sensationalized to tell this story that Dungeons and Dragons was like a demonic entity that you shouldn't allow your child to be exposed to. And it is funny what you said earlier when you said when I asked if you remember the Satanic Panic and you said, "Well, yeah, now that I think about it," and it's amazing how many people I've talked to who after reading the book remembered like, "Oh my gosh, there was a satanic panic in my neighboring town," and they'd completely forgotten about it because it's just we just threw it all away. And I'm 10 years younger than you. And so by the time I was in middle school, we were in that period where the satanic panic was over and it was just in the garbage. And so I was really confused when my school librarian said we couldn't have a Dungeons and Dragons club because I hadn't heard any of this stuff because I was too young when it was happening. I was like 5, so I wasn't absorbing it. But the kind of reverberations of it were still present, and people still had this vague idea like, I know Dungeons and Dragons is evil, but I can't remember why. And then it like takes on a life of its own, and people forget the origins of these strange phobias.
And just to kind of, because it is interesting to me, and because I wanted to make sure that the facts were on this podcast. So it is Monsters and Mazes was based on a book, which was based on what's considered an apocryphal thing that happened, where this young man, James Dallas Egbert, I believe he left his dorm room after writing a suicide note, entered steam tunnels of the university, consumed drugs and intended to commit suicide. And then it just like, and the people who were,
Yeah, that's what
who,
I recall,
yeah.
that it wasn't even about a murder. It was about a
No.
suicide. And it
Yes.
sort of morphed into, and he went on a murder spree. And it's like, no, this was a severely depressed person
But he
who.
just happened to play Dungeons and Dragons, and
Yes.
people saw him at Gen Con, and like, it's the most bizarre thing. It's like you can't be like, well, would you be like, because Jeffrey Dahmer watched Peanuts? I don't know if he did. I'm just making this up. Like Charlie Brown is,
But Charlie Brown turned him into a serial killer.
100%. You heard that here first. That is 100% not true, and I don't know if he was a Peanuts fan, but I'm just making stuff up, much
Well,
like
and
the Satanic
and
Panic.
I'm it's so related to struggles that you and many librarians, I imagine, must go through with this idea that books will like flip a switch in a child and make them evil or make them perverted or change their sexual orientation. And it's just like this almost this very superstitious relationship to books and media where it's like we can't expose the child to that because it will just do them this irrevocable harm, as if a book is like this is magical. And like I believe books are magical, but not like that.
I mean, if you were born in 1985, you remember the Never Ending Story, so you know all about how
Oh yeah.
perfect.
Oh yeah. And it's like books are transportive and they are life-changing, but it's like they're not going to turn you into a demon. And to kind of try to see their point of view, it's like books can be disturbing. there are some things where it's like, maybe I shouldn't have read that when I was so young, you know, but overall, an attitude of seeing books as dangerous or seeing a game as dangerous, I just can't get behind.
Agreed, 100%. So, I mean, I could talk about that with you for hours, but I won't, because we're here to talk about your book.
I mean, I imagine, yes.
Yeah. So the main character of this book is Lacey, and she is the daughter of two parents who run a daycare, and they're hippy dippy parents, and they are accused of abusing their charges. And this is again another real thing that happened. And you know, it turned out to be 100% bunk, and the people who were accused, their lives were destroyed. But for Lacey, she's got a lot going on, and there's just so much in this story that she goes through, aside from just the fact that her parents are accused of this, and she's put into the spotlight with her sister, who is a very interesting person. And she's queer, Lacey. And, you know, we're in a different-ish place depending on where you live. You know, where I'm trying to remember, and I think you might have mentioned it in your book, where homosexuality was taken out of the book for a, you know, a...
It was in the late 70s.
Yeah. Which is actually much longer than I thought it was, which is also still very sad that
yes.
I am like,
that
oh, no,
wait,
I
long.
Thought it was sooner than that, which is also very depressing. But, you know, like, she's a queer teenager, and she's basically prey for tabloids and for people who really want to be like celebrity psychiatrists. And she just wants her family back. And she's coming of age where, you know, she has this sister who is gorgeous in every way, but she's also a nutcase in every way too. You know, she really deals with things in a different way. She lived on her own with a guy for a while in Florida. And she comes back, and just all this media attention on both her sister who's soaking it up, and Lacey, who really just wants it all to go away and wants her
parents. Yeah, the sisters have very different relationships with the media attention. And Claire, the older sister, is kind of, she's shining. And in a weird way, you know, she's almost enjoying it because, and you know, I wanted a Claire to feel like a real person, but also very informed by like a sort of 1980s American ideal of like, it's all about glamour.
Yes.
And anytime a camera is pointed at you, that can't be bad. And
yes.
Just clothes. And so she's trying to kind of make the best of it. And Lacey is just mortified and just wants to crawl in a hole and die. So I really wanted to show like the two very different relationships with media attention.
And I really, I mean, I say that Claire was a bit of a nutcase, but I really did feel for her because she...
Oh, I love a Claire.
Yeah, I really felt for her. I mean, really, like, half the time she was there, I'm like, a Claire, you gotta stop. Like, this is not helping anybody. This is not helping anybody. This is not helping you, which it doesn't ultimately. And I don't really want to give too much about that away. But at the same time, you know, like, you see somebody who's really like, there's so much pain in the exposition, and it's so real.
Yeah, I wanted to, I'm glad that you feel that way, because I really wanted to show with Claire, I feel like people who are transparently hungry for fame are super demonized. And I wanted to show like, someone can be hungry for fame and they're still just a girl. They're still a person full of love, full of actually an extraordinary amount of desperation, because that's what's driving that desire for fame, is just feeling of desperation, of being lost and unmoored unless people are paying attention to you. And I don't see that as demonic. I don't see that as evil. I understand it can be obnoxious, but I really wanted to humanize that type of person with Claire.
And she's very young. You know, when you first meet her, like, I'm wondering, how old is this older sister? But, you know, she's on the other end of a phone talking to Lacey. And when she actually comes home, you're like, oh, she's a child. Like, really? Because her parents were very, very young, or her mother, I should say, was very, very young when she had her. So, I mean, really, the, you know, again, when I said she was a bit of a nutcase, it's not because she was unhinged to be unhinged. There were no hinges that she had throughout her whole life. She really just clung to what she
the
could.
The door was off the hinges, just an open void.
Yes, she wasn't given really any ground.
No boundaries.
Stand on, no boundaries. And, you know, she clung to whatever she could. And at one point it was this guy who clearly was done with her, even though she didn't want to admit that. And then, you know, the cameras were there. And I do think a lot, you know, I think a lot about just sort of how the media treats abuse survivors, and also just people who are in the midst of a tragedy. And it's really just very, very sad. So, you know, both her and Eclaire were almost, like you were saying, like opposite sides of bait. And, you know, for Lacey, I should say her and Lacey were opposite sides of bait. But for Lacey, you know, so she has these people who say that they're her therapists and they want to help her through this, but they're going through this whole, you know, repressed memory thing, which is another thing that is dubious science that people used
and
to do.
In real things that happened in the 80s, where, you know, a psychiatrist in Canada sort of invented this technique of memory repression therapy, where he would have these intense therapy sessions with his patient who he then went on to marry.
This is the Michelle Remembers.
This is Michelle Remembers. So it was already, you know, not good professional boundaries in that relationship. And apparently, and he claimed that through hypnosis, he unearthed Michelle's repressed memories about having experienced and suffered satanic ritual abuse as a child. And none of this was ever verified. There was never any proof that anything Michelle claimed had happened, but the book became a bestseller. The therapist became famous, and it kicked off this phenomenon of memory repression therapy. And it turns out children are especially vulnerable to these techniques because they have a less firm grip on reality. So if you tell a child over and over, didn't something terrible happen to you? Didn't a demon with wings do something bad to you? They will start to believe it. And I wanted to show kind of how unethical it is to mess with children's minds like this, especially when the therapist is transparently trying to do it for profit, you know, to make a name for themselves.
The other thing that's crazy is that these therapists like zero in on the fact that Lacey's queer, and
that is ammo for them.
Yes, it's ammo. And it also leads to different kinds of abuses. And it just, like, it really was just such a heart-wrenching thing to go through with her. And then at the other end, you also have, you know, the fact that, like, her lawyer wasn't particularly, wasn't 100% on the ball. And that's all I'll say for all of his efforts. And she also has this friend that she has known since the very beginning of those days in Dylan, who becomes also a pivotal character within this story. Now, Dylan brings up a whole other aspect to things that had been happening back then. So were both Lacey and Dylan main characters in the story when you started writing it?
Yes, they definitely were. And I wanted, you know, I wanted to show, I have sort of, I'm very interested in kind of litigating the past. One of my favorite things is to reunite with someone I haven't seen since I was 7 years old and kind of like see which memories we share and which memories we differ on and kind of compare the ways in which we saw each other. And it's always surprising, like, oh, I thought you were the coolest girl. No, I thought you were the coolest girl. And you know, it's so I wanted to show kind of a friendship that evolves over decades, and also how, you know, two people, because the book is so much about memory, and, you know, Dylan, when Dylan tries to reaffirm what Lacey says, that Lacey's parents didn't do anything and they were falsely accused, you know, Dylan is also just sidelined and marginalized and exploited by the therapist. So I kind of wanted to show how even when a friend tries to back you up, the system is very good at doing a divide and conquer and trying to break both of you and turn you against each other.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I don't know that it's much better.
I don't know that it is either, sadly. Like, it's that's and that's the thing about the book. I wish it weren't so relevant, even though it's set, you know, it's set in 1990 and then we do a time jump to 2006. And it's unsettling. It's unnerving. How little has changed. And we simultaneously think the 80s and 90s and even the 2000s were so long ago. But that only shows how short our memory is, because they were yesterday and society has not moved that much further, has not progressed, you know, in a super meaningful way. And of course, things are a lot better, especially in many areas of the country for queer people. But in a lot of areas of the country, they're the exact same.
Yeah, definitely.
And even in areas where things have really progressed for queer people, I think there's a lot of kind of hypocritical expectation of, we accept you, we embrace you, but only if you act like a normal heterosexual commerce-driven American citizen. Like, it's not really an embrace of queerness. It's an embrace of queer individuals if they conform to, you know, the heteronormative police state of America.
I mean, like that whole, like, you know, oh, you're just like us.
But you're just like us.
Except for when you're like not.
And it's just like, thanks. Like, I remember hearing, just being pummeled with you're just like us messaging as part of the campaign for marriage equality. And, you know, now we're seeing that just like us, it got us marriage equality, but now we're trapped, you know, we're trapped in this situation where we have to be, you know, we have to be so virtuous. We have to be just like, you know, we can't subvert society. We have to be good. We have to be good gays.
The book was great. I mean, I really, really liked it. Is this your first adult book? You've mostly written YA?
It's my first adult book, yes.
What made you kind of jump to adult? And was that kind of always the direction you were going in, do you think?
Well, interestingly, I started with adult, and I started this because I started this book in 2008, I think, when I was like 23 years old. And I never wanted to do YA. I wanted to be an adult writer. I was very ambitious, but I just still had the mentality of a teenager, and I just couldn't really back it up. And so I switched to YA, and I found that I really loved expressing myself and expressing the feelings of youth and expressing that. And so I wrote, you know, 4 young adult books, and I loved them so much. And then by the time I was finished with 4, I felt like, oh, I might be like all grown up now. I might be finally mature enough to go back to this book that I didn't have the maturity to write when I was 23, which isn't, I'm not trying to sound insulting towards YA and say that YA writers are immature. I'm not saying that. But I just do think that to write a book that is for adults, that is a different, that's a different mindset, and it's a different art. And I definitely was not ready for it before, but suddenly I was just like, I'm a grown up now.
Are you working on something for the future?
I am. It's going very slowly, but I'm you know, I'm always working. I'm always working. I can't not work. So I have, I always try to be very encouraging towards people who want to write novels and encouraging people to embrace failure, because I write a novel every single year and I've maybe written like 15 and only 5 have been published because the rest just aren't good enough. And that's fine. You know, give yourself permission to write a bad novel. It's the only way that you will grow enough to be able to write a good novel. So what I'm writing right now may be bad. It may never see the light of day, but I'm always writing.
That's pretty great. What are you reading?
Oh, what am I reading? I just read the new Bret Easton Ellis, The Shards, and that really blew me away. I also just discovered, I'm kind of late to this party, but I just discovered Mona Awad, and I'm really excited. I loved Rouge. I loved Bunny. I'm also always rereading classics, like my faves. I read Bleak House like every 18 months. I love Charles Dickens. I used to read a lot of YA, and two of my books are graphic memoirs. So I used to read a lot of comics too. But right now I really am craving adult literature. I still feel like I'm very much in that headspace.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited. You also mentioned the Crestomancy books in this, which I'm excited because you don't hear enough about them. And I just don't know why. I don't know why they didn't get bigger around here. Like,
that book changed my life.
So
Which week? I read it when I was 13. Oh, I love that book. Had such a profound influence on me. The way the characters felt so real and flawed and vulnerable, and the witchcraft was approached in such a serious way, not like a not like a Harry Potter fun way, in a very serious way. And I loved it so much. I would really recommend, I should put together like a Rainbow Black reading list, and which week by Diane Wynne Jones would be at the top.
That was a really good one. I'm trying to remember that whole series was really good. And there was one where like they're turned into puppets at one
Oh,
point.
Yeah.
That one was super creepy. I love that one.
Yeah. And yeah, the Crestomancy books, I'm so glad you mentioned that. And I'm glad that you enjoyed that reference.
Yeah, I think you know, I didn't discover them until much later. My sister-in-law was the one who told me about them. You know, everybody knew Howl's Moving Castle.
Oh yeah,
which, you know, that's Diana Wynne Jones too, right? I'm not making
I think
that.
So.
Yes, you know, and Howl is wonderful and amazing, and the movie as well. But I understand why Christopher Chant was a lot of people's literary crush. There is just, you know, he's a very interesting guy, and the world that he inhabits is really cool. So yeah, check those out. Even adults, they're good.
I co-sign that.
Yes. All right. Well, this is Jessica with Syosset Libraries Turn the Page podcast. Thank you so much, Maggie Thrash, for coming and talking about Rainbow Black.
Thank you, Jessica. Thank you for your interesting questions and your interesting insights into the Satanic Panic. It was really fun to talk to you.
You're welcome. We are going to close this chapter of Turn the Page.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.